separated from its paperwork. Well, thank you very much, Peter, for letting me come and speak to you. I appreciate it very much. Could you just say for the tape, please, your full name and your date of birth?
Yes, my full name is Peter William Stanley Farrant, and I was born on the 31st of October, 1924.
Mm. Thanks. Well, as you know, we're interested in the history of the island's tourist trade, and in your capacity as an official of the Isle of Man government and also practising at the Manx Bar, you saw various aspects of this. Perhaps you could tell me a bit about it.
Yes, just for the record, I was never an official of the Manx government. I was Vicar General, but that was a church official. But of course I was an advocate in practice from 1951 to 1993. And during that time, of course, I did come across quite a bit about the tourist industry, particularly in Douglas, where I lived and practiced. Now, you did ask me one or two questions that you wanted answered. So I've made some researches and I've combed my memory. Now, as far as I know, the tourist industry in Douglas started about 1870, when they completed the Lock Promenade. You asked me what sort of people were in the business, who ran the hotels and the boarding houses. Well, I would think that from the beginning it was probably always a mixture of Manx people and outsiders, who could be English, Scots, Welsh or Irish. I don't think we had many foreigners, although I do remember, of course, the famous Mr. Leslie Ranieri, who ran the Onconhead Hotel, and he was an Italian, and there may have been others. And of course, I think in latter years, there were one or two Hong Kong Chinese, and there may even be some Hong Kong Chinese there today. In my recollection during my childhood, because of course I was born in Douglas, and I do remember the great days of the tourist industry prior to the Second World War, they were always known by those who didn't like boarding house keepers and hoteliers as rather a feckless types, because they worked extremely hard during the season, and it really was very hard work, because the smaller houses were always run by the wife, and to make a profit, the fewer staff you employed, the better, so that during that 6 weeks, and you must remember that the early pre-1914 and possibly in the 20s, the season was only 6 weeks, 2 weeks in July and four in August, and that's all it was. So they did have to work very hard when they did. It was only the larger establishments which had hotels, which had staff, such hotels as the Sefton, the Palace Hotel, the Castle Mona, the Villiers, and so on. And their life revolved around the season. They all went on holiday in October, and they did make a good living in those days. They had their holidays, then they had a really prosperous Christmas usually, and it was only in January that they got down to painting their houses and getting ready for the season. So I think those who had a 9-to-5 job and in the civil service as a farmer and so on, they were all very modest incomes in those days, and the boarding house keepers were regarded as rather a lucky and prosperous class. You have to remember, as I say, that the season was so short before 1914, and you also have to remember the character of the people who came here. They were, up to 1945 anyway, mostly mill workers from the mill towns in the north. There were quite a lot of people from Glasgow, Scotland, Liverpool, but they were working class. And the working class, as you probably know, before 1914, had a pretty hard time. They worked very, very long hours. They got very small salaries. But I know that my mother told me she can remember the pre-1914 crowds. Some of them would get holidays of as little as 3 days. But she said they were so happy. You would see them on the promenade, they'd all link arms, and they would come down doing booms a daisy, you know, cheering, laughing. And she said you could see how badly fed they were. Their physique was not like people's physique today, and there were many cripples. You would see them crippled in the Industrial Revolution. But they were very happy people, in many ways happier than tourists today. It's extraordinary, isn't it? The more you have, you'd think the more you smile, but it doesn't seem to work that way. My mother always said that. They were a very happy crowd, and of course the facilities in Douglas, as you probably know, in those days you had the Derby Castle, the theatre at the end, the dance hall there. You had the palace, great palace ballroom. You had the cinemas, 5 cinemas. Innumerable pubs, of course, with very long drinking hours compared with England and Scotland. You had the ferries going across the harbour, the incline railway, up to the great big Douglas Head Hotel and the little theatre, which is still there, the open-air theatre, and then you went on the trams to Portsoderick. And I well remember as a boy at 4 o'clock, it was a wonderful sight to see something like 6 or 8 boats all leaving at the same time. Beautiful boats, unlike today, with some with 2 funnels, lovely red funnels. They were things of beauty, those old boats. And of course they would be coal burners, the columns of smoke would be going up, and they would all be leaving at 4 o'clock. That was the time when the boats went back to Liverpool, Llandudno, Fleetwood, Dublin, Belfast, and so on. It was really very exciting to see. As you probably know, after the 1950s and 60s, there was this great decline in the industry, leading to the final virtual collapse in the 80s and 90s, and now I think it's about 25%, isn't it, along the front, something like that. But you did ask me how was the industry operated? How much knowledge did I pick up of this through my conveyancing work? Well, when I first went into practice in the 50s and later in the 60s, conveyancing for a Manx advocate, a large percentage of it was the purchase and sales of boarding houses. Now, you asked me what the sort of prices would be. Well, to give you an idea, when I bought my first house in Douglas, Cronkbeg, Eleonora Drive, which you can go and see, it's a nice little house, it's still there, I paid £3,700 for it. That was the price. And as far as I can recollect, a small boarding house in, say, Farran Street or Peel Road, places like that. And you have to remember that the boarding house and hotel area was very much greater than it is now. Upper Douglas was full of boarding houses. Well, I would imagine that you could buy a house in Farran Street, for example, it would be £200 or £300. And some of the larger houses, none would be over £1,000. And in those early days, I suppose, even the largest hotels, the price would not exceed £10,000, I shouldn't think. I mean, if you had a conveyance with £7,000 or £8,000, that was big stuff. So it gives you an idea of the kind of prices in those days. Of course, they did gradually edge up. But I don't think when I did sort of the last conveyances that I dealt with, which would be in the late 70s, early 80s, I don't think any would exceed £50,000, even the largest places. And they didn't touch, and I don't think they touch now, the quite enormous prices that you can get for new houses and houses in the country bought by wealthy new residents. The prices for boarding houses and small hotels became almost derisive in the last days of the industry. Well, you ask me how they financed themselves. Well, as you probably know, the Promenade was built, largely built, by the late Alexander Gill. I think he was a Scotsman. My mother remembers him. She said you would see him standing on the promenade directing his workmen while they were building these houses. And he, of course, as most builders, successful builders are, was a very tough character indeed. Of course, he made a fortune. And one of the ways he sold his houses, of course, was by giving a mortgage. So if you bought a house for, say, a good house for, say, £500, you would get £200 mortgage from him, or maybe more. It used to be 50-50 in the old days. It was only in the last days of the industry where they, in order to get a sale at all, you had to give a mortgage of about 80%, which, of course, was shocking. So these houses changed hands for a very small sum in cash, and it was all a loan. And, of course, you had to pay interest, but that was the only way you could sell your house at the end, in the last days. But Alexander Gill, of course, after the building was finished, his income, of course, came from all these mortgages. In those days, it would be 2.5%. 3.5% it paid promptly on the 12th of November or the 12th of May, 2.5%. The interest rates slowly rose, and I suppose by the early 70s, of course, it had crept up to maybe 5 or 7. And then, of course, when the great inflation came in 73 and we had 32% inflation, obviously the boarding house industry was affected like everybody else, and the interest rates became absolutely crippling. 18% and that sort of thing. It crept right up to 18 to 20%. It's hard to believe these days, isn't it? And we're now getting the complete reverse. We're now going back to rates of interest, which I knew when I bought my first house in 1961. However, you asked me the machinery of buying and selling a boarding house. Well, I think that didn't change. The prices changed, but the procedure didn't. The bricks and mortar were dealt with by the conveyance. And for the small houses, you only paid for the bricks and mortar, but you paid nothing for goodwill. It was considered that small houses didn't have goodwill. So on the deed of conveyance would be recorded in the deeds registry. And if you got a mortgage, of course, which in the Isle of Man is called a deed of bonded security, and it is different in form from an English mortgage, and that remains to this day. I don't want to go into those technicalities. And the deed of conveyance would be recorded at 11:05, and the mortgage would be recorded at 11:06. It had to be after the conveyance, and occasionally mistakes were made, and the mortgage went before the conveyance, and that was extremely awkward if that happened, but of course that. So you recorded your mortgage, and then there was a third document, the deed of assignment, and the deed of assignment would be the furniture, and you had to covenant, of course, that it was not on hire purchase, or if it was, you had to produce the situation. You had to be careful about that. And that didn't go into the deeds registry. That remained on the lawyer's file. So if you go to the deeds registry, you won't see these deeds of assignment because they were not recorded. At the same time, you would hand over the visitor's book. That was the most important thing, because from that book you saw the sort of income you were likely to make. And in the early days, I don't think they kept accounts. It would just be the checkbook and the bank book. But as the years went by, of course, things, particularly after the Second World War, accounts were prepared so that you could actually see what the takings were. I'm talking about small houses and small private residential hotels. Obviously, hotels like the Sefton Hotel and the Palace Hotel, plainly, they were limited companies, and of course they kept accounts. They were in a different class altogether, but there were very few of them. That's how you got your visitor's book, and of course that you were handed over the deposits which the vendor had collected. You asked me the dates of the sales. It would usually be the 12th of November or the 12th of May, the half-yearly dates. If it was the 12th of May, of course, you would have collected quite a lot of deposits, and it was quite a bit of money. So that had to be handed over and accounted for very carefully, and many a dispute arose because money had gone missing, deposits had been paid, which had not been accounted for, and so on. That was all business for lawyers, and was the fruit was a the, you know the fruit of many the cause of many disputes, but still. So that's how it was done. I don't think in pre-war days. I think bank overdrafts for boarding houses, and indeed for people who bought houses, were very rare. They didn't have bank overdrafts. And I think that bank overdrafts for boarding house keepers only came into vogue in the 60s and 70s when the industry charged higher prices, standards went up, and banks had more confidence in them. So I think the banks gradually, of course, as with everything else, by the end, the last days of the industry, of course, the banks were supporting them all round. And the old gill mortgages and that kind of facility had gone. Most of the gill mortgages, I would say, were repaid by the early 80s. Alexander Gill had a son, incidentally, also Alexander Gill, who was a very well-known town councillor, MHK, MLC. Of course, they were rich people. He didn't have to work. His son is Charles Gill, who is now a man of nearly 90 years old. He lives at Greba Castle, and he married Elin Gill, who was the daughter of Sir Hall Caine, as a matter of interest. So that's how the industry was financed, as far as I know. And I remember the settlements dates, you would have the settlement would be the purchase price, say £1,500 less than a 10% deposit, which you'd already received, and the balance you would receive plus the value of the furniture.
And in the early days of your career, would you have said that most of the boarding house keepers were on rents, most of them were on mortgages? What was the proportion of those paying back a mortgage to those who were maybe renting them, or, you know, the ownership would be held by someone who owned the boarding house as an investment, say? Did that sort of thing go on? Would you know?
Yes. Leasehold tenancies of boarding houses were rare. They nearly always bought the freehold, but again, it was nearly always on mortgage. And the trouble was, the mortgages in those days were not repayment mortgages, because the guilds and people like that wanted an income from them. So they never repaid them. Of course, with inflation, the value obviously fell in the 70s, and you were in a favourable position when you were a borrower. But that wasn't the case in the 30s, of course. It was rather the reverse. And one of the criticisms of the boarding house keepers is that they never owned their premises. And they soaked them for every penny of profit, and they didn't plough anything back. That was one of the criticisms. Well, in as you probably know, in the 50s, the Isle of Man Tourist Board replaced the old publicity board, which was what its title implies. It was to do with the publicity for the Isle of Man, and that was all. But when the tourist board was formed, one of its chief objects was to raise the standards in the industry and to compel boarding house keepers to put in more lavatories, hot and cold water in their bedrooms, because the facilities were pretty primitive. Do you know that my mother told me that in the great days, if you like to call it that, of the industry before 1914, they used to let attics in Derby Square, and there was no furniture. You just slept on the floor with a candle and loved it. You know, I mean, that was the kind of thing that was going on. Well, by the 30s, things had improved. But after the war, when continental holidays started, it was belatedly realised that the standards were so good on the continent compared with the very rough conditions here. So the tourist board started a registration scheme, and they also arranged for tourist loans, which slowly improved the conditions of the buildings and the facilities. And of course we had the Summerland fire in 1973, and there was an absolute panic, panic about fire escapes, and many a boarding house keeper was nearly bankrupted by what he had to do. They used to come in absolutely grumbling, because although they got a loan to do it, it still cost them money, and it was a very hard time for them, perhaps because they hadn't done what they should have done before. They'd simply soaked the industry for many, not all of them, but some of them had.
Were they reluctant to improve because their houses were on mortgages and because they felt they didn't own them?
I think so. It did, the mortgage system did inculcate an atmosphere of getting every penny of profit you could while you could, and you didn't put money back into the property because you didn't really own it. Although you owned it in name, but you weren't repaying the mortgage, because the mortgage wasn't a repayment mortgage. So you had no incentive to do so. Your incentive was to make as much money as quickly as you could. So in a sense, it was a bad system and was partly the cause of the very poor facilities, which sadly, in some cases, still exist today. That was the tourist board. You asked me about for actual names of people in the industry. Well, I remember Ranieri, who you've probably heard about from other people you've interviewed. He was a real character, and I can remember the Bradleys of the Falcon Hotel. They were a very well known family. The McAleers of the Dog's Home. If you interview Robert McAleer, who runs the Creek Inn, he will, I'm sure, tell you all about the tourist industry from the publican's point of view. In the pre-war, which his father would, of course, remember, and in the post-war period, the Dog's Home was one of the most popular pubs in Douglas and much frequented by visitors. And, of course, it was very, very profitable. They made fortunes in places like that.
You mentioned Mr. Ranieri. Can you tell me a bit about what was he thought of in the town? What was he...
He was very much admired. He ran a very successful business, and he did invest money. He even installed a swimming pool in his hotel, which was a very bold thing to do in those days. But he realised, he was more than just a boarding house keeper, he became almost a local politician. And 30 years ago, he used to write letters to the paper, he used to make speeches complaining about the future of the industry, and he foresaw what was going to happen unless things were changed. And he tried his very best to improve conditions. And I suppose to some extent he succeeded, but he couldn't reverse national trends where everyone goes on a continental holiday. I suppose you could say there wasn't very much you could do about that. You could do a certain amount, but you couldn't alter it. But that's how I remember him. He was always writing letters to the papers and making speeches. He was much admired. And then I had some clients, very nice people called the Rigbys, who ran Silver Craigs on the Palace Promenade.
Was it Ronnie and Mary Rigby?
Yes. And they were people who... people came to their hotel over and over again. They knew them, they were friends with them, and they treated them very, very well. They were people like that were wonderful. And of course, obviously, they went on very much longer than those who didn't treat their visitors like that. But the Rigbys were a real Manx hotelier family who gave good value.
And can you tell me about the sort of business you'd do with the Rigbys professionally? What sort of things would they come to you for in an average year?
Well, not very much, really. A well-run house, which, of course, they were, you never saw them. But with the badly run houses, of course, you did see them. You either saw their staff who'd been sacked without notice, or they got into financial difficulties. Of course, I had many, many hoteliers and who came in and we bankrupted and so on. That's what you mainly saw. You didn't see successful people like the Rigbys. You never saw them at all. You see, most of lawyers' business is dealing with people who are in trouble and in difficulties.
And what would people do if they came to you in difficulties? What would their typical situation be? A bankruptcy threatening?
And you have to advise them, and if it's hopeless, you have to say, well, you'll have to make a deed of arrangement. Or if it was a bad case, they were made bankrupt. There weren't very many, mind you, because a lot of them were such small businesses that it didn't even merit a bankruptcy. But those are my recollections of the hoteliers and boarding house keepers' problems. Now, is there anything else that you could that you'd like to know?
Oh, just going back to the furniture question. Was that usually sold with the hotel, or would people have their own?
No, it was always sold with the hotel, because it was obviously furniture of a special character. It was very rare for the purchaser to tip all the furniture out and put in his own stuff.
And did you get a sense of the hotel keepers, your perception of them as a group of people? Can you tell me a bit about what you thought and saw about them sort of looking in? Did they tend to... be united, for example, or were they quite divided in what they wanted the government and the council to do? Were there sort of some strong figures that stood out and lobbied, or were they generally quite passive? How did they work as a group?
Well, 25 years ago, the Boarding House Keepers Association was very strong, and they used to have frequent meetings. And I think if you look at their records, I'm not quite sure where those are kept, but you'll see that they were very active. They were always negotiating with the tourist board. They were always agitating with the steam packet company, always agitation to lengthen the season, to Sunday opening, lengthening the pub hours, improving the gaiety, the entertainments. They were very active. But as the years went by, and as things got worse, they lost heart. And I think in the last few years, particularly when I became chairman of Douglas 2000, I went down to the front and I visited one or two hoteliers. And they told me that the association was now very small, and many members didn't turn up because they felt that the situation was hopeless and there was nothing that could be done. It was rather sad, and I came across that personally 3.5 years ago when I took over this job. And of course, many of them Their main concern was to be allowed to sell to a purchaser who would turn their house into flats. And there was quite a lot of trouble with the corporation and with the planning authorities over that, because they literally could not sell their houses. No one wanted to buy except to convert. And some of the houses were suitable for conversion and some of them were not.
Can you tell me some more about that, the question of the flats and the whole thing about Douglas 2000? How did that come about, and particularly focusing on the promenade and the ex-guest houses in other parts of Douglas that might have been affected? You know, what was the thinking in Douglas 2000 about them? What were the ideas you were having?
Well, you must have an interview with our development manager, Guy Wiltshire, and he will give you a lot of information on these points. But generally speaking, when we started Douglas 2000, we took over from the previous regime. Unfortunately, there was a dispute between the then development manager, Andrew Harris, and the result was that the Douglas Development Partnership, or the Douglas 2000, it was then known, didn't operate for about a year until I took over, and my job as chairman, I was brought in to revive the thing, to restart the meetings, and hopefully to get